Alrighty. So if you've got Psalm 4 open, that might be helpful. Not a big psalm. And it's a psalm that David wrote, as you can see in the heading on the NIV, for the director of music with stringed instruments. It was for the guitarists, a psalm of David. So one of the things that I've noticed with the English language, all languages are living things, in the sense that they change over time and they grow and they develop. They're not a static thing. You know, young people, they change the meaning of words. They say fully sick is a good thing or whatever. I know that's really old now and they don't do that anymore, but whatever it is that they do, it's a mystery to me. But they do it and they change the meaning. And so language is always a living thing, but there's a laziness that creeps into the use of language as well, where we take sort of the lowest sort of understanding or meaning of something, and we use that so that, because it's easy. And so often dictionary definitions don't give us, I guess, the fuller meaning. And sometimes we lose out as a result of that. So if you were to look at a definition for peace, for example, then this is a dictionary definition for peace. It says, first of all, there's two possible meanings. Freedom from disturbance tranquility. Can't talk. Oh, by the way, I had a shingles injection this week, and so that's going on as well. So who knows what I'm going to say. Anyway, freedom from disturbance, tranquility. And then it gives an example, which I think is so meaningless. He just wanted to drink a few beers in peace. Now, peace, that's a name of a pub. Okay. So it doesn't actually tell you what peace means by that example, does it? But it says it's a freedom from disturbance. So that is a definition that I find always a bit wishy-washy when a definition is actually, this word means when this is not there. But what is it? What is it? You know what I mean? What is peace as a positive definition, not as a negative thing, not as, well, when that's not there? So it does offer it with tranquility. That says it is a time of tranquility or a situation of tranquility. The second one is a state or period in which there is no war or a war has ended. And so the example, once again, meaningless. The straits were to be open to warships in times of peace. Do you know, they might open them in times of war as well. So that's weird. But anyway, so basically, though, it's once again a lack of. It's a state or period in which there is no war or a war has ended. Well, actually, peace can be more than that. Do you know you can actually have a time, so you can be in your family and there is no war in the nation that you are in, and yet you cannot have peace in your family. You know that. So it's more than that. So to me, those definitions aren't helpful. Now, I don't know if you remember, but when we looked last year at Psalms of Joy, we had this problem with defining joy as well, because the dictionary definitions often said joy was, do you remember? Happiness. And yet happiness is usually defined negatively as a lack of problems, a lack of conflict, a lack of bad things. That's happiness. I'm happy because nothing's going wrong. But we found that joy was something that could be found even in the midst of troubles or persecution. When there could be hard times or bad things happening, you can actually have joy. It had a depth to it which took us beyond just happiness. There's another word I've had to define for you as well, in the sense that I think our Western modern enlightened thinking has reduced it, and that is knowing. We just think knowing is an intellectual. Somebody told me about that, so I know it. Whereas the biblical understanding of knowing is always experience. It's always so much more than that. And so when it comes to this idea of peace, freedom from disturbance, tranquility, a state or period in which there is no war or a war has ended, I don't think that's enough for what we want to understand peace to be. The word that is translated as peace in Psalm 4 is a word that you may have heard before. It's shalom. It comes from the Hebrew word shalom, and it means this. And notice that peace is only 25% of this definition. So there's still 75% for us to discover. Completeness, soundness, welfare, what? As well as peace. There's a whole lot more going on in this word that's just translated as peace, let alone just put aside our English understanding of peace as well. To go on, and this came from from the internet, so you know it's true. It says shalom is translated as to make it good. Or she'll surely pay, or make full restitution, or to restore. Are you seeing some of the picture there that this is a whole, this is actually a positive thing? Like, it's not just because there's a lack of conflict or war. That's not restoration. Restoration is when something positive comes in, doesn't it? And so this is the ancient Hebrew meaning of shalom, which is where shalom come from, was to make something whole. Not just regarding practical restoration of things that were lost or stolen, but with an overall sense of fullness and completeness in mind, body, and estate. There is so much more going on. So I just want to raise the size of our understanding of peace for a moment when we come to a psalm of peace. And I'm going to have to move really quickly this morning, but I do want to give you some visual clues. I don't know what you are like and what that does for you. For some of you, that will bring peace, won't it? Now, we're all different. Some of you, if that red line, if it gets to here, you're still okay, aren't you? I know you're out there. I've seen you on the side of the road with your jerry can. I actually hate it down there, and I now drive a Toyota Prado which has two fuel tanks with two gauges. So I can drive around with two gauges on E, living on the edge, as it were. And as I do that, see, I'm a Presbyterian minister, so I hate spending money. Right? And so I'm there. Why am I on E? Because I love it? No, I hate being on E. I don't get peace on E, but I just don't get peace in going to the service station either. So I avoid that. I'm trapped. But for some of you, I know some of you, when the red line gets to the fuel Bowser symbol halfway, you panic, don't you? There's some people here like that. You panic at halfway. I just have this message for you. Get over it. It's okay. You have these things that go through in your mind, don't you? If it gets to halfway, maybe it's inaccurate. Or if it gets to halfway, it's going to suddenly drop or whatever. Or maybe there'll be a hurricane or I'll be stuck in the snow and I'll have to run the engine for the next 48 hours or something. Who knows? I don't know. There's reasons why you do what you do. We're all different. So peace, this idea of fullness, we actually can really get caught up with what fullness is and what it is for you and what it is for me and where we have peace in that and where we don't. I can, and so everybody may be under the age of, 15, 25, I don't know. Just tell me if it was painful for you later. You might want to look away. This may be anxiety causing. Are you okay? Just breathe. It's all right. This is bad, isn't it? This is bad. This is, for some of us, not peace bringing. This is anxiety bringing. Why? Well, the interesting thing is that it may not be simply because, and it does depend on your internet usage and why you're there and what you're doing, but this being taken away from us can cause a bit of problem. And there's actually a good reason, potentially. If you've got really close friends overseas who live a long way away, you'll understand why, I guess, because it means more than just whether your phone's going to be alive or dead. This actually means whether you can talk to somebody, whether you have connection, whether you can see them on a video chat, whether you can hear them. This is something about a little bit more, I guess, of a fuller and more complete picture. Now, the interesting thing is that this symbol, the Wi-Fi or the, you know, connected to the network type idea. Once again, it depends on why you're using this. But for some of us, this means we have an opportunity to be known. This means that we have an opportunity to know somebody, have this opportunity. So I'm in several groups, you know, those groups that you can be in, like on WhatsApp or Messenger and things like that. Some are family related, some are work related, church related, small group related, DNA group related. There's a whole different range of them, and this symbol, it's connected to all of those. This way that I am known and am able to know. It's not the only way, but it's one way. It can signify that. And so connectivity, the opportunity to know and be known, and that's actually how Psalm 4 starts. Psalm 4 starts with this. If you got it, you might want to read it. It says, "Answer me when I call, It says to you, but if you took the two out, it really, wouldn't it? It'd be this all over, wouldn't it? You answer when I call you, my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, one of the worst things about Facebook Messenger, with WhatsApp, I think it has little ticks, but with Messenger, once their little profile picture has dropped to the message, I go, ha, they've seen it. Okay, they now have 30 seconds to answer. Nobody entered into that contract. We didn't, did we? But we all do it. Why? They've seen it. Why haven't they answered? I think something's wrong. I've offended them. I don't know what's wrong. I better send them another message, quick. But it's interesting because in this psalm, he's called out to God. And he says, answer me. I know you've seen the message. You've seen the text. Answer me, my righteous God. Give me relief from my distress. Have mercy on me in my prayer. Now, the psalmist, he wants to be known by God. He's seeking this connection with God. He also, in doing that, wanting to know God, knows something of himself, doesn't he? Notice how he's aware of his distress. He's aware of his issues that are going on. And that's one of the reasons why he wants to connect with God, so that God can do something about that. I'm going to skip verse 2 because it's problematic and I don't want to talk about it. No, it actually fits in with where I'm going to go. But if we just jump down to 3 and 4 for a moment. It says, know that the Lord has set apart his faithful servant for himself. The Lord hears when I call to him. So he knows. He knows God hears. He is known by God. He has a sense where he understands that and he knows that. Remember, biblical understanding of knowing, he's experienced it. He's experienced that God hears him when he calls. Verse 4, tremble and do not sin. And when you are in your beds, search your heart, be silent. Offer the sacrifices of the righteous and trust in the Lord. He calls David, I guess the other people who will read the psalm, he calls them, he encourages them to know themselves and God. He encourages them to come into this knowing, to this connectivity with God. And in doing that, he mentions for the first time, and it's not the only time in the psalm, the bed, lying, sleep. Now, this is a psalm about peace, and he's just made the connection for you, but I'm sure it's a connection you've all made, isn't it? I mean, is there not a link between sleep and peace? Or maybe if I put it in the negative, a lack of sleep and a lack of peace? Yeah. Does everybody here sleep really well no matter what's going on? No. Peace impacts that, doesn't it? Whether we have anxiety and the other things that are crowding in on our life will impact us and affect us. And so he says, well, when you're in your beds, search your heart and be silent. In your bed, you've got this opportunity. See, that's one of the reasons I think why the bed, sleep, and peace has this relationship, because it's the whole world is suddenly quiet, isn't it? You're in bed, there's nobody else knocking on your door and giving you demands and all this stuff. You're finally now in a place of quiet, and what happens? Your own head within this loudness starts. And so the psalmist David, he says, search your heart and be silent. Get yourself right with God, offer the sacrifices of the righteous, and just trust in him, he says. There's this thing that he's trying to invite others into with this psalm. This opportunity to be known by God, the one who knows you and loves you and accepts you, and for you to know him, the one who hears you, the one who is trustworthy, the one who looks after you, the one who hears you when you call. To know and to be known. I was struck by a quote by Thomas Merton that I stumbled across in this last week, because it mentions peace as well as happiness, though maybe he really means joy. Thomas Merton maybe was a little lazy at that point with language, but he says, there's only one problem on which all of my existence and my peace and my happiness depend. To discover myself in discovering God. If I find him, I'll find myself. And if I find my true self, I'll find him. That sounds like it's just a circular thing, and he's not saying anything at all, but he's actually saying a lot. He's talking about a true self. He's saying, when I find that true self, who I really am, if I am able to see myself as I truly am and not the false pretense that I put forward to the world and often to God, if I find that, then I'll discover who it is that God really loves and how much I am loved. And I actually think, and Merton links this in with peace, I actually think this is the key, really, with peace. And so as we look at the verse that we've just looked at, tremble and do not sin, when you are on your bed, search your heart and be silent, offer the sacrifice, get right with God, bring your true self to God, let him know who you really are, because he already does, but it's going to be helpful for you to know that he knows who you really are. Truly self-accepting of self as you are, as God, actually brings peace, a completeness, a fullness. And there's a result to this, being known by God and knowing that you are known by God and yet still loved and accepted. As it says in verse 8, where David lands the psalm, he says, in peace I will lie down and be awake all night. No, he doesn't say that. I will lie down and I will sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. When I'm actually as known as I really am in front of God, I know that he knows who I am as a broken person. When I know all of that, I know I'm safe because he loves me and accepts me as I am. That's where I find peace, says David. In this place of being known by him, I'm safe. There's no pretense. But it can take time to find that peace. It can take time to know that God actually does accept us as we are. None of this is like one day I thought God didn't accept me as I am and now I really do, to the very depth and core of my being. It takes time. It's a little bit like hugs. I don't know if you've ever seen, the research on hugs. I don't know if you're a hugger. If you're a hugger, you're probably going to love this. If you're not a hugger, that's all right. God's with you. You can sleep well. It's okay. But there's two things about hugs, the research tells us. One is how you hug. And so guys, we often do the side hug, don't we? Side hug is less confronting. It's also we try and minimize the amount of skin to skin or, you know, body to body contact. I just want to say nobody has to hug anybody they don't want to hug. That's fine. This is how to make hugs helpful, okay, to get the most benefit out of a hug if you are going to hug. Going to hug, do it properly. And so the research says that actually if you face each other, it does enable a greater contact. And so there's a little bit more meaning to that. A side hug is a protected hug. But then there's this other thing about hugs as well. It says this, what makes the perfect hug? It goes on to say the length of the hug matters too. Now, I don't know, you may have heard this. This is something we've talked about with people I love. The length of the hug matters. Studies have shown that hugging for 20 seconds or more is what maximizes oxytocin production. You need to have a 20-second hug. If you are having less than a 20-second hug with somebody, you are cheating them, you're cheating yourself, you're not having the benefits of the well-being of a good 20-second hug. And can I just say, you don't have to stop at 20 seconds. The hug lovers just went, oh, yes. Goes on to say, now, 20 seconds may seem like a lifetime to be clinging on to someone else, but it is at this point that a real sense and notice of trust is established and our emotional capacities are positively influenced. The perfect hug is a hug delivered properly. Now, the interesting thing, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've tried to do this with people I love, as well as just random strangers on the street. No, just joking. And what I've noticed is that, it's like, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. This is just the way it is. You go in for a hug, and you're there. And so for me, it's like, it's not 20 seconds yet. And then you notice there's a relaxing. And the two people, you two of you, sort of lean in and accept the hug. And you actually feel the two bodies relaxing. We are so busy in life that the ones we love the most We don't even hug them properly a lot of the time. Now, some of you might be huggers and might be doing this already and might be going, hey, I don't hug for less than a minute. I commit. And that's great. But for many of us, we don't. Why do we rush a hug? Now, there's sorts of things. There's time pressures. Some people would say, look, you spent too much of your life hugging. But it's more than time pressures. Notice the word trust. We often don't allow ourselves to do the things that let trust in. What is all this in aid of? Well, as a human, you need time and space to grow in certain truths and realities. I think that's why you need more than a 20-second hug. If somebody goes up to you and go, hey, hey, you can go, well, I mean that much to them. Somebody commits to the 20 seconds, you'll be thinking one of two things. One, I mean a lot to this person. Or you might be thinking, I'm really worried. There's this thing called contemplative spirituality. Contemplative just means sitting with realities, thinking them through. And it's an interesting way of doing a relationship with God because it sort of takes that 20-second minimum hug theory into your relationship with God, where it says, I'm going to sit with God and I'm going to do it for more than just 10 minutes reading something somebody else wrote and then praying a prayer that somebody else has written. That means I'm going to sit in his presence and I'm going to try and internalize and really know, not just up here, but allow it to sink into deeper levels, that God loves me, he accepts me as I am. Notice if I put two things from the psalm together. When you are on your beds, search your heart and be silent. In peace, I'll lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell in safety. What do you need to internalize, to find acceptance of your true self and to find this peace? Because I think this is what undergirds this peace. I say that for several reasons. I've got a Henry Nouwen quote that's up there on the screen now. And just notice what he says. He says, we are not what we do. We are not what we have. We are not what others think of us. That's actually the false self. The false self is caught up with this idea that I am what I do, that I am what I have, and I am what others think of me. And so I've therefore got to do the right things, I've got to have the right things, and I've got to make sure people think the right things about me. But that's actually the false self. And he wants to say, no, that is not who we are. He then says, coming home is claiming the truth. I am a beloved child of God. We no longer need to beg permission from the world to exist. Coming home to our Father is when we realize we don't have to beg to have permission to exist. God's given us permission to exist and he accepts us as we are. We get caught up on the first list. You notice those first three things don't bring peace? Being caught up about what we do and what we have and what others think of us, those things do not bring peace. In fact, they are three of the things that most drive, I think, anxiety and a whole lot of other issues that are so prevalent today and on the rise. What brings peace? Coming home to that truth. I'm a beloved child of God. I no longer need to beg permission from the world to exist. If you were to put it into the words of the psalmist, in peace I'll lie down and sleep. For you alone, Lord, make me dwell. I've come home to you in safety. Now, I said I was avoiding verse 2 because I didn't want to talk about it because it was a hard one. I actually think verse 2 and Henry Nouwen help bring it together because verse 2 says, how long will you people turn my glory into shame? How long will you love delusions and seek false gods? How long will you get caught up with the idea that it's all about what you do and what you have and what others think of you? Because it's not. Why will you turn my glory into shame? I invite you in because I love you. And you make it all about shame. So I'd love to give you a practice, and I've gone over time, and I apologize for that. How to be filled with God's love, three steps to experience God's love. This is a practice I found during the week, and I wanted to share it with you because I usually, in some way, sort of point you to points two and three, but not point one. Point two, ask God to direct your heart into his love. This is a prayer, so use it. These are not my words. I copied these words, but these are essentially the point. So that's the second point, is that you pray, you talk to God. The third one is to gaze. That's the contemplation, to sit into the love of God, gaze into the love of God in Jesus Christ. We've talked about using our imagination over the last few weeks, how you can imagine different scenarios with you and Jesus and his love. But I haven't really talked about the first one, which is, I think, just worth alluding to before I finish up, and that is to be dissatisfied with your present spiritual experience and cultivate a holy discontent. I guess I usually start from the point of assuming that we're dissatisfied with where we are with God, but that may not be the case. You might be very happy and content with where you are with God. I just want to encourage you, no matter how good your connection with God is, because of the nature of being in this broken world and us as fallen human beings, it can be better. There is more. And I can say that for myself. I can say for every single one of us here, there is more. And so I just want to encourage you today to think about that holy discontent. Being dissatisfied with what you have. Do you have enough peace? As we look around the world at the moment, I don't think there is enough fullness and contentment and being made whole. I'm not whole enough. I want to encourage you in that. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, thanks that you love us. Thanks for Jesus. Thanks that you are home and that the door is open. Or in the words of the prodigal son, that you come out and meet us as we are on the road to you. And on that road to you, we are often weighed down with our own brokenness and shame about how fallen and sinful we are. And yet there you are. If we use our imaginations for a moment, running towards us. It's a picture that I hope ushers in peace. In you, everything's okay. In you, we can stop striving. As we think of Jesus' words in Matthew 11, we can finally find rest. And I pray, Lord, that in each and every one of us, you would, just grow that holy discontent, or to maybe put it in a more positive way, that hunger, that thirst for you. And Lord, as you do that, as we find you and as we find our true selves loved by you, may we find peace. In Jesus' name, amen.